Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you all to this Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Antisemitism webinar, being given by Aidan Beattie. I'm especially delighted to be able to welcome Aidan. I've been aware of his work for a number of years now, and it's really good to be able to welcome him to the Institute. He's a historian from Ireland who now teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. He's the author of Masculinity and Power in Irish Nationalism, published in 2016, and he's the co-editor of Irish Questions and Jewish Questions, Crossovers in Culture, which was published in 2018. And today he's going to talk for about half an hour on sexual fantasy in antisemitism. Aidan.
Thanks a lot. I'm just gonna share my screen. And thank you so much for this chance to present this project. As Dr. Feldman said, a lot of my work has been on certain kinds of Irish-Jewish stuff, whether it's comparative work or anti-Semitism in Ireland or philo-Semitism in Ireland, and then also some work on the perception of Ireland in Israel. I co-edited this book in 2018, Irish Questions and Jewish Questions, and I think I even saw one of the other contributors to that pop up on the Zoom call today, Tricia Oakley Kessler. Several of the essays in that book, including Dr. Kessler's, are on Irish Jewish history, like the specific story from Irish Jewish history, and then move to a much broader and seemingly unconnected story about the vocabulary of 21st century politics. And then the rest of what I will talk about today will be how I think these two seemingly very disparate stories are actually very much intertwined. In January 1904, a relatively young Catholic priest named John Cray began a campaign of intimidation against the small Jewish community in Limerick, on the west coast of Ireland. Using his own religious pulpit, Cray was able to foment a program of economic boycotts against Jewish merchants in the city. Some acts of non-lethal violence against the Limerick Jewish community also took place. And by the summer of the following year, 1905, the Jewish community in the city had halved in size. Collectively, these events have become known as the Limerick boycott, usually seen as the most extreme moment of anti-Semitism in modern Irish history. They're extreme by the fairly quiet standards of Irish Jewish history, far less extreme, I think, by the broader perspective of European Jewish history. Cray had been initially encouraged in his actions by local native-born traders who resented the economic competition of newly arrived Jewish grocers. And his sermons drew on all the standard tropes and accusations of pre-Vatican II Catholic anti-Judaism, particularly accusations of deicide and accusations around Jewish involvement in the Dreyfus affair a decade earlier. And analyses of these events generally echo this, explaining the root causes of the Limerick boycott in terms of economic competition or religious bigotry. And more broadly, these seem to be the two most common modes of historiographical analysis of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism as a kind of misfired class consciousness, what the German Marxist August Bebel is apocryphally said to have called the socialism of fools, or anti-Semitism as the result of a recurring Christian anger about Christ killers who have refused to accept the supposed messianic truth of Christ. My research project, however, investigates a different strand, one that I believe is central to anti-Semitism. In the first of his notorious sermons, John Cray aimed his wrath at Jewish usurers, who are usually a conventional target of anti-Semites, but then added a charged and very gendered and even sexualized twist, claiming that rural housewives were the most common targets of Jews selling goods on credit in the agricultural hinterlands of Limerick. As Cray said, The Jew has got a sweet tongue when he wishes. He passes off his miserable goods upon her, upon housewives. She has to spare and stint to get the money to pay off the Jew without her husband knowing it, and then follow misery, sorrow, and deceit. The wife is afraid lest her husband should find out that she has been dealing with the Jews. The wife will beg the Jew not to come to her house. She does not want him to be seen coming. And then stealthy visits must be paid at night in the darkness, lest the dealings might be found out, he said. And Cray went on to claim that if his parishioners would visit the home of one particular Jewish moneylender, they will be surprised to see the number and class of people who are going in and out to pay the Jew his usury. In barely concealed terms here, Cray was making a very specific accusation about the dangers of implicitly male Jews. And the language used here, most particularly this phrase, stealthy visits in the darkness, seems designed to simultaneously prick the masculine pride of his audience whilst also offering up a hint of sexual titillation. Father Cray's charged accusation then, it seems to me, is that Irish men are being unknowingly cuckolded by Jews who have trapped their wives into giving them sexual favors. And the second story I want to tell is about this word cuckold. Deriving from old French and etymologically related to the word cuckoo, cuckold is a generally pejorative term. Just as a cuckoo unnaturally lays her eggs in another bird's nest, so also a cuckold is an unnatural man who allows another man to enter his home and have sex with his wife. It entered the English language sometime around the mid-13th century and had become a more obscure term by the 20th. But what I'm particularly interested in is the strange way it recently re-entered the English language. Sometime around 2015, the term cuckservative began to be used in far-right circles, particularly on the internet, particularly in the US, to describe conservative American politicians who are supposedly too moderate or too willing to compromise with Democrats. It has since been shortened to the more succinct and aggressive sounding cuck, which is generally regularly used as a noun, a verb, or an adjective. So for instance, Mitt Romney is a cuck, but also Mitt Romney has been cucked by Donald Trump, and anyone who does not support Trump's agenda is a cuck liberal. And it's a word that has begun to circulate far beyond its original extreme right-wing base. Cuckservative as a term is a borrowing from a very specific genre of pornography. In her brilliantly provocative book, Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men, Jane Ward provides a useful definition of this particular cuckolding pornographic genre and its standard plot. As she says, a straight and typically white man discovers that his wife or girlfriend is cheating on him with a stronger, sexually powerful, and typically black male rival. Feeling emasculated and undeserving of his female partner, the white man watches her have sex with his rival and is told he must submit to both of them in order to keep his wife. As a genre, it combines sexual titillation and gratification, features of all genres of pornography, with humiliation and the deploying of longstanding racist assumptions about black male sexuality. Or as Andrea Long Chu has said in her recent short polemic, the trope of the black man's penis as large, threatening, and tremendously potent is an old one, of course, the standby excuse for lynchings and white supremacist terror, and it's found all across the pornographic spectrum, not least in cuckolding porn, in which white boyfriends and husbands are forced to watch and occasionally participate as black men have sex with their eager wives and girlfriends. For Chu, the classic explanation for this fetish is the revolutionary Frantz Fanon's theory of negrophobia as a kind of murderous envy, the white man projecting onto the black man the infinite virility he worries he lacks. The paradox of white supremacy, Chu points out, is that it's actually a kind of inferiority complex. The white man, who could have just as easily fantasized that the black man's penis was smaller than his own, because either one would be a kind of fantasy, nevertheless opts to imagine himself as a sexual failure, going limp in the presence of the black man's unlimited sexual potency. Seeing this genre of pornography in these terms fits closely with what Julian Carter has identified as the paradoxical ways in which whiteness is constructed with and through images of perennial weakness. In his work, The Pervert's Guide to Cinema, Slavoj Žižek commented that pornography is a deeply conservative genre because of the way it always seeks to flatter its audience's fantasies, never to confound them or supersede them or push them in new directions. This specific genre of pornography that I'm talking about is more than just conservative, it's deeply reactionary, and not only employs racist tropes, but works to recreate them. That pornography would be so openly racist is hardly surprising, since racism and bigotry are themselves often noticeably pornographic. I'm thinking here of the ways in which anti-Black racism often makes claims about Black male sexual potency, lust, and rapaciousness. Stories about Black male lust for white women, which Andrea Long Chu points out are often the opening pretexts for lynchings, often play on these highly sexualized and even pornographic tales. Or I'm thinking of the ways in which Black women are often depicted in the white supremacist imagination as either having freakishly weird and hyper-feminized bodies, or just as being hyper-sexualized receptacles for white male sexual attentions, as Dorothy Roberts discussed in her book, Killing the Black Body. In his recent monumental work on racial violence in the United States, Walter Johnson has discussed what he calls all the torture and violation by which white people have historically drawn pleasure from the suffering of Black people. Johnson then goes on to speak about white men's anxiety that white women might have unfulfilled sexual desires and that those desires might lead them into the arms of darker men. But he also notes the ways in which such an archetypal white man can transform his anxieties into optimism, his fears of sexual inadequacy into a sensation of erotic potency, fueling the sexual energy that these white men felt as they murdered a Black man whose projected animal appetites they openly condemned but secretly desired. Johnson summarizes this as the circular expression of inadequacy, entitlement, privilege, and violence that we might call imperial whiteness. And to me, the parallels here between pornography and racism seem instantly apparent. When I talk about racism and pornography, I'm also thinking of the ways in which Orientalist art in the 19th century depicted a vaguely defined East as a luxurious space of sexual license, whether a heterosexual license or a homosexual one. It's worth remembering the shared history of Orientalism and anti-Semitism, not least the ways in which 19th century Jewish women were simultaneously sexualized and orientalized and imagined as both seductive but also sexually dangerous. We could also recall the manner in which contemporary Victorian white slave narratives combined anti-Semitic claims about foreign-born Jewish men dealing in flesh with Orientalist fantasies of beautiful white female captives in Eastern harems. This Orientalist idea of sexual license and freedom finds a certain kind of echo in contemporary Britain and in racist panics about Pakistani grooming gangs. As Gargi Bhattacharya and her collaborators recently said in their group written work, Empire's Endgame, these collective threats to the nation are imagined to play by their own different rules and therefore to be acculturated within some other moral order and system of authority, embedded in an alternative and unknowable form of social organization, both dangerous and seductive. It's not just the idea of being somehow simultaneously dangerous but seductive that I'm interested in my work, but also the violent grievance that underpins this, that they, racial outsiders, are allowed to get away with things that we would never be allowed to get away with. And it's these three elements, danger, seduction, and a kind of violent racial grievance, that recur within the history of anti-Semitism and that I'm going to talk about for the rest of my paper. I would also say that all of these are, in one way or another, sexual fantasies operating through racism and racial fantasies operating through sexualized imagery. Many years ago, in his famous work on the paranoid style in American politics, Richard Hofstadter made the astute observation that anti-Catholicism has always been the pornography of the Puritan. Anti-Catholic screeds, such as the notorious 1836 hoax, the awful disclosures of Maria Monk, played on the notion that Catholics were sexually depraved, but also by describing their sexual actions in extreme detail, provided a forum for sexual titillation. The center argument that I want to pursue here is that anti-Semitism and particularly anti-Semitic visual material often operates according to a similar rationale, welding horror and arousal at one and the same time. Or to put it differently, scholars of anti-Semitism often overlook a key truth, but I think an uncomfortable truth. For anti-Semites, anti-Semitic culture is a pleasant thing to experience. It is designed to be titillating and even gratifying in the same way that pornography is. anti-Semites like Father John Cray know exactly what they're doing and how they're hoping to appeal to their audience when they engage in fantasies about, in Cray's case, Jewish men cuckolding their Christian husbands. And indeed, this kind of pornographic imagery and titillation recurs again and again in the history of anti-Semitism. Already in the second century, the Roman historian Tacitus claimed that the Jews are extremely loyal toward one another and always ready to show compassion, but toward every other people they feel only hate and enmity. And although as a race they are prone to lust, they abstain from intercourse with foreign women. Yet among themselves, nothing is unlawful. As one scholar has recently said, Tacitus offers up not so much an honest or balanced account of the Jews, but rather provide a generalizing description built on the reification of an entire community into which a particular disposition and way of life defined by outrage practices and obstinate attitudes. In other words, Jews, for Tacitus, were defined by their lustful and taboo-defying sexualities, as well as their self-regarding particularism. These claims of Jewish lust and hypersexuality in time came to reinforce Christians' self-image of universalism and ascetic spirituality and were common currency in the ancient Mediterranean. Synagoga, the standard visual personification of Jewry, and her opposite, Ecclesia, both underwent important shifts in the move from late antiquity into the medieval period. From being a pitiful remnant of divine history, synagoga instead became a common whore led astray by her lustful nature. Synagoga was conventionally depicted holding a decapitated ram's head by its horns. As well as referencing the ram sacrificed by Abraham on Mount Moriah in Genesis 22, this symbolized Jews' animalistic sexuality and carnality. The oversexed ram of Judaism is contrasted by the docile lamb of Christianity. In this 13th century stained glass window in Marburg in Germany, synagoga grasps the ram by its phallic horns and points its mouth towards her genitalia. Subtle smiles play on the faces of both the ram and synagoga, and as a further demonstration of her duplicity, her left eye is visible through the blindfold. The true harlot, she feigns modesty, yet watches all with a hungry eye. The church watches with disgust from the left panel, and I think it's quite important that the church does watch. Does look on this kind of scene of sexual monstrousness. The Judensau, the Jew's pig, a common image in various woodcuts and even church relief carvings in medieval Germany, is another well-known example of medieval sexual anti-Judaism. Its depiction of Jewish men directly feeding from the teats of a sow is intended to suggest that Jews, who claim an abhorrence of pigs and pork, are in fact hypocrites who literally love pigs. It's a satirical image that is clearly supposed to titillate its Christian audience via a depiction of Jews engaging in bestial sex. In his famous 1943 work, The Devil and the Jews, Joshua Trachtenberg observed that Judensau images often also featured the devil supervising the action. Another popular Jewish caricature depicted Jews riding backwards on goats as a symbol of their general unnaturalness. And you can see some of these caricatures on the front cover of Trachtenberg's book. As Trachtenberg points out, the bock or billy goat is the devil's favorite animal, frequently represented as symbolic of satanic lechery in the Middle Ages. So sex resides just below the surface here. And Trachtenberg has quite rightly, I think, spoken of how anti-Semitic tales and folk imagery functioned as both sources of entertainment as well as instruction. Jews in these caricatures and in these images were comic as well as vile creatures. As Alexandria Kufel has shown, popular conceptions of Jewish perfidy in the Middle Ages were regularly conveyed through images of filth, animality, and somatic disgust. The Judensau as an image could be placed alongside the claim popular throughout medieval Western Europe that Jewish men menstruate as a result of the blood guilt they are said to bear for the deicide. Building on Kufel's work, my argument is these kinds of claims were not just intended to disgust their audience, but in some cases to titillate them with images of the sexually weird and the freakish. Medieval and early modern discussions of Jewish circumcision were also designed to be titillating, albeit using more coded language and coded depictions. in Italy as early as the 14th century and continuing into the 18th, publicly performed farces called judiata or Jew dramas featured pantomimes in which actors dressed to represent rabbis were endowed with oversized priapic noses, raced about the stage bearing long knives, threatening to slice off the other men's monstrous appendages. This image here is a depiction of a judiata from the 1940 Italian fascist and overtly anti-Semitic publication, The Defense of the Race. I would ask you all to look at the character's nose and think about what it's really supposed to represent. Jay Geller, in his incisive but not always easy text, The Other Jewish Question, spoke of circumcision as the indelible index of Jewish embodiment, a part of the male Jewish anatomy and an obviously sexual body part at that, which cannot be seen but must be shown. I would argue the coded titillation and a sort of eye-winking set of comments and jokes has long been the way that this bodily marker of Jewishness can be telegraphed whilst also not being openly mentioned. And returning to this image that I started with, a vaudeville-era American postcard, the coded references here to man as a pork sausage and thus to penises definitely seems to fit with that. But obviously this is not a hard and fast rule, and there are examples of far more graphic and perhaps even pornographic depictions of Jewish circumcision. The satirical British pamphlet, The Christian's New Warning Piece, or a full and true account of the circumcision of Sir E.T. Barrett, is an illustrative, if bizarre, example, and I want to quote from it at length. It was produced during the often polemical debates over the so-called Jew Bill of 1753, which, had it passed, would have given voting rights to British Jews, but which was defeated amidst claims that it would give too much rights to Jews. This particular pamphlet described the fictitious circumcision of a minor Whig politician, one Edward Turner, the ET that you see mentioned here, who was said to have submitted to the operation, to the circumcision, as a condition of receiving Jewish financial support in his bid for a seat in Parliament. Having decided to finance his bid for Parliament by forming an alliance with those enemies of Christianity, the Jews, he applied to a Mr. Gordon. That courteous gentleman, the pamphlet said, replied that if the rite of circumcision was complied with and he were once in possession of Sir E.T.'s foreskin, everything else would soon be made easy and they might command their own terms. On the return of the messenger, Sir E.T. seemed much perplexed at the thoughts of circumcision, but being encouraged by those about him, he at last consented to undergo the operation. All matters being thus settled and the day of circumcision fixed, Mr. Gordon came down the night before and brought with him the famous Mr. Moses Ben Amri, so celebrated for his easy and expeditious method of performing this Mosaical ceremony. The group assembles on a Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, when a circumcision would never take place. And when the doors have been locked for fear of the Christians, the Moyle delivers a sermon on the slaughter of the men of Shechem following their agreement to be circumcised. An example he advises the prospective convert to be emulated. The charge being ended, which was received with great applause by the whole assembly, Sir E.T., rising from his chair, all pale and trembling and with some hesitation of voice, which was supposed to proceed from Mr. Moses Ben Amri's inadvertently producing the circumcision knife just at that juncture, expresses uncertainty and anxiety about whether submitting to circumcision will indeed guarantee him the desired support. Whereupon his Jewish patron, fearing that the business he came upon might be entirely frustrated, assures the trembling politician that as soon as the Jewish polity were established in England, E.T. would become Member of Parliament for the New Jerusalem. Upon this, the little baronet, with great agility, mounted the table and, unbuttoning his breeches, laid himself on his back. The Jewish operator, attending on the right side of him, and Mr. Jenkinson, one of his colleagues on the left, who very prudently held a bedpan under his breech for fear of accidents from that quarter. Then Mr. Moses Ben Amri approached with great solemnity with the forceps in one hand and the circumcision knife in the other, and having muttered some words in Hebrew, he lifted up the flaccid prepuce and at one dexterous stroke severed it, nevermore to return to the stump on which it grew. It's going to get somewhat worse as it proceeds. The victim is so terrified that he urinates right into the mouth of the unfortunate Jenkinson. According to the pamphlet, the Jews had promised the concised prepuce as a trophy, but one of the onlookers stole it, apparently in the belief that properly prepared, it would serve either in the aid of seduction of women or perhaps to guarantee a firm erection. He carried it away to his chambers, where he washed it and squeezed it and twisted it and turned it and hung it from his window on a stick to dry. Then again, he soaked it and stroked it, and again, he dried it and stretched it. The expectation is that young women shall feel unusual raptures from his fond embraces and bless the kind, invigorating contrivance. The narrator laments that the same portion of matter which was wont to contribute to filling up the measure of chaste connubial love should now be destined to be the instrument of rank debauch and priestly lechery. The Jewish negotiator, having been deprived of his trophy, intended presumably for the same purpose, declares himself absolved from the contract, leaving the hapless ET with neither finances nor foreskin, which is where the story ends. All of this is clearly supposed to be funny and to titillate the audience with overtly and quite explicit sexualized humor. I'm agnostic as to whether it be called pornography in any conventional sense, but it is clearly using anti-Jewish humor to get away with hypersexualized content. And I think in a manner that confounds Jay Geller's claim that circumcision can never be directly discussed. On the other hand, depictions of Jews in the Nazi era Der Stürmer shared a graphicness with pamphlets like this, but little in the way of humor. And they tended to fit the description of pornography better. Many of the caricatures appearing in Der Stürmer already in the Weimar period seek to directly play on accusations that Jewish men are gaining undue sexual access to Aryan German women. At certain times, this seems to encode a certain kind of economic grievance, claiming Jewish men had a wealth that gave them a life of free sexual access or sexual ease, all supposedly denied to German Gentile men. Other caricatures in Der Stürmer presented Jews as rapacious threats to German Aryan womanhood, though often with a graphicness and explicitness that to me suggests the purpose is slipping into the pornographic. It also seems to me that in the rape fantasies of Der Stürmer, the problem is not so much that these women are being raped, but that they are being raped by Jewish men rather than their rightful Aryan male possessors. And indeed, a cartoon from August 1937, 2 years after the implementation of the Nuremberg laws, depicted the new sexual ease enjoyed by Aryan men in a Germany no longer beset by allegedly lustful Jewish men. All of these caricatures in Der Stürmer seem to be designed so as to invite and gratify the desires of their readers, playing on a sense of sexual humiliation, whilst also holding out a vision of sexual gratification and overcoming the Jews that are here blamed as the cause of German men's sense of impotence, the national impotence that followed the imposition of the Treaty of Versailles, perhaps collapses here into a more personal sense of sexual impotence. In his recent book on the myth of Judeo-Bolshevism, Paul Hanebrink has shown how Nazi anti-Soviet propaganda during the war, particularly as the Soviets started to defeat the Nazis, often used these highly graphic kinds of rape fantasies and allegations as a way to further inflame German opinion against the USSR. Nazi anti-Soviet propaganda was markedly sexualized, often indulging in rape fantasies. In occupied Poland, for example, a widely circulated brochure depicted a Red Army soldier, whip in hand, clutching a helpless Polish woman while a lust-filled Jewish male figure looked on over his shoulder. The image was titled "The Fate of Women Under the Jewish Bolshevik Whip." And these kinds of sexualized anti-Semitic propaganda have had an oddly persistent half-life. In their recent book on Los Angeles in the 1960s, Mike Davis and John Wiener discuss what they call a toxic rumor that circulated in Southern California in the summer of 1964. By the eve of the November presidential election between Goldwater and Johnson, this rumor had spread virally across the entire country and infected political debate everywhere. The story was variously set in Southgate or Culver City, two suburbs of Los Angeles, and claimed that a group of adult black males had castrated a three-year-old white child in a public bathroom. Everyone knew someone who knew someone else, or everyone white knew someone who knew someone else who could verify the story, which was supposedly being covered up by liberals. And then the columnist Paul Coates of the Los Angeles Times stumbled upon what he believed was the true genealogy of this rumor. According to a letter he received from a reader who had been in secondary school in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, The same story had been used by Nazi leaders to enrage Hitler youth before pogroms. Only then the little white boy of the story was a German boy, and the so-called colored hoodlums were Jews. Clearly, sex and racism were reproducing each other here in this specific moment. This specific variety of pornographic anti-Semitism, which oscillates between humiliation and gratification, has indeed reemerged in the United States in recent years. According to the Great Replacement Theory, one of the most popular contemporary anti-Semitic conspiracy theories of the so-called alt-right, Jews are said to be masterminding a population decline of the white race. What's less noticed, perhaps, is the second half of this story, that white men, with possible echoes of Dr. Strangelove, are offered a potential Judenfrei future in which they will get unfettered access to white women so as to repopulate a supposedly depopulated white race. As some analysts of the far right, like Talia Levin and Christoph Kerl, have begun to unpack, this is essentially an invitation to engage in gratifying sexualized fantasies. And there's a litany of historical precedents for all this. Stereotypes about Jews and the sex trade were so common in early 20th century Argentina that Polaca, the Spanish word that referred to immigrant Jewish women from Eastern Europe, became a common term for prostitutes there. Polaca functioned as a similar code word in Brazil and in the years leading up to President Getulio Vargas's declaration of his Estado Novo dictatorship in 1937, the Plano-Cohen conspiracy theory fabricated a Jewish communist plot to invade the houses of wealthy Brazilians and rape them. Even more bizarre was the fantasy that coalesced during a resurgent white slave panic in Orléans, Grenoble, and other French cities in the late 1960s, when Jewish boutique owners were charged with drugging teenage girls in their fitting rooms and spiriting them along underground passages to waiting submarines. In the Leo Frank trial in 1913, one of the most notorious anti-Semitic moments in modern American history, the target of this blood libel, Leo Frank, was described in one local press report as the typical young libertine Jew who has an utter contempt for the law and a ravenous appetite for the forbidden fruit, a lustful eagerness enhanced by the racial novelty of the girls of the uncircumcised. Also worth recounting are the curious ways in which anti-Semitic views of sexually dangerous Jewish men coexist with similarly essentialized, if sometimes more sexually appealing, beliefs that Jewish women are exotic and sexually exciting, if also still somehow dangerous, albeit arousing and dangerous. As early as the Middle Ages, conversion to Judaism, always a rare occurrence in the medieval period, was classified as a form of dangerous seduction in many Christian texts. Dangerous because, as well as losing access to the grace of Christianity, a convert will also have to undergo adult circumcision. And to return to Ireland, both in the 1930s, when a ban on contraception was introduced, and then in the 1980s and 1990s, when contraception was made legal again, there were publicly made claims that condoms were a Jewish plot against Catholic Ireland. In a recent article of the Israeli history journal Zion, Susanna Heschel argued for what she called an erato-historiography of anti-Semitism, one that is alert to both the micro-history of anti-Semitism as well as the macro-historical ways in which certain tropes or claims about Jews recur across vastly different times and places. But she also calls for an erato-historiography that, as the term suggests, is able to see the ways in which anti-Semitism plays on the emotional, the intimate, the personal, all in ways that are comparable to other forms of racism. My own sense that I want to end with is that historians, in describing the grotesqueness of anti-Semitism, often unconsciously slip into tacitly assuming that everyone else finds this stuff equally grotesque and horrible. What we thus miss is that for anti-Semites, anti-Semitism is often a deeply pleasurable experience, even an erotic one, and it was probably even designed to do all that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Aidan. That was extraordinarily wide-ranging a paper and a thought-provoking one as well. I should begin with an an apology, which is at the outset, I should have invited everyone, if you have a question, please place it in the chat. And from the chat, I will relay your question to Aidan. Mm-hmm. But I'll take advantage of my position and I'm going to ask an opening question, which in a way picks up on where you left off, which is, could you say a bit more about what you would like your study to do to mm-hmm. the historiography of anti-Semitism? Mm-hmm. Is this something which you think sort of adds on a significant dimension which most scholars have missed or averted their eyes from until now? So it's an add-on. Mm-hmm. Or is it something which, once we take it seriously, makes us reconsider how we think about the history of anti-Semitism?
So I sort of started off this project, I think, in the way that lots of people start off lots of projects, where I thought I've discovered something totally new. And then the more I read on it and the more work I did, I realized this is not as new as I thought it was. And mm-hmm. other people have been doing this work already and doing it in quite smart and innovative ways. I think other than this thing of basically saying, we need to recognize that, you know, we look at anti-Semitism differently than anti-Semites. And what they are getting from this is not necessarily what we would get from this. The other thing I really want to do with this is I do think there is a problem with the study of anti-Semitism and maybe just Jewish studies in general, that it tends to be a little bit insular. I think Irish history has the exact same problem. And I find it very kind of disconcerting that there is this incredibly rich literature on Jewish identity and the ways in which non-Jews perceive Jews and that affects how non-Jewish perceptions of Jews affects Jewish identity. And then that never seems to exist in conversation with the history of race in the US. And sort of contemporary discussions about racism seem to happen in kind of a separate track completely from contemporary discussions of anti-Semitism. And there are reasons to think of both of them as different phenomena, and they are different phenomena, and yet they would benefit from a kind of cross-pollination. I think that is something that I want to try and do with this work.
Thank you. Well, I have other questions, but there are many more which are coming in, so I'll mm-hmm. I'll reserve mine for later. The first is from Noel, who asks whether you wanted to say anything about the role of sodomy, broadly defined, in this strand mm-hmm. of discourse.
I'm trying to think if I've even come across anything that looks like sodomy. The one thing that I would maybe bring up is there's a scholar called Ellie Bromberg that had a book recently about claims that sort of the anti-Semitic history of incest and how incest is often used as an accusation against Jews. And he makes a sort of a throwaway comment at the start of the book about could we trace kind of hysteria about pedophilia back to the blood libel, and that the blood libel has this kind of, because it's always supposed to be targeting a child or targeting a boy, is that kind of, is that where like hysteria about pedophilia can be traced to? And he makes it in just this kind of off the cuff way and then never really investigates it. And I think there's something really fascinating there. If we're assuming that this stuff is about like sexually freakish stuff or like claiming the Jews are sexually weird, then you would expect to see sodomy. And yet I'm kind of struggling to think about any time I've seen that. You do see the stuff that looks like pedophilia. You do see stuff that looks like that is bestiality or claims of bestiality, but I've never I can't think of anything that sounds like or looks like sodomy. On the other hand, if this is about like a grievance that like they're getting away with things that we're not getting away with, it's very heteronormative in that sense. It's about Jewish men are getting to have sex with women in ways that we're not. So I don't know if sodomy would be as much of a relevant topic there. I know that Noel has been doing kind of somewhat similar work. So if this is a leading question, I'd love to hear more from you.
No, it's not. Although I am thinking of sodomy in the 18th century sense, where sodomy is much wider than just anal intercourse between men. So where sodomy would include things like the urinating into another man's mouth scene in the Christian's Warning piece, but also just the fact that many of these activities are male and male dominated, including the, you know, the image you've got of the pig, for example, that it's all men interacting with each other sexually as well as interacting with this animal. But it wasn't the leading question. I was just asking.
Okay. All right. No, thanks so much.
We have a question from Fernando Herrero, who says sexual fantasy can go in many directions. You have addressed many contexts, and those contexts can function differently from each other. Things can get really messy, he writes in inverted commas. What do you make of Stalag fiction, for instance? What do you make of this sexual fantasy?
I have to admit, I don't know what Stalag fiction is. If Fernando wants to kind of unmute and explain that, I'm...
Well, let's move on, because I think there's another, there are lots of questions. One from Stephen Frosch, who asked about the absence of explicit psychoanalytic references, which have covered this ground. He mentions A Male Fantasies by an author whose name I've never been able to pronounce. which examines the defensiveness of the fantasy of the Jewish and Bolshevik Red Woman and the fantasized wholeness of the Aryan male with the de-eroticized Aryan mother and sister. The Lacanian idea of the theft of enjoyment also meshes with this. Racism as containing the fantasy that the enjoyment to which we are entitled has in some way been stolen from us. So he asks, where might psychoanalysis feature in this work?
So I really struggle with Klaus Tabold's work because I it's just such a weird book, and it's sort of hard to know what to make of it. And often it seems like, I mean, some of his claims I assume are like mostly discredited now, about like that Nazism is a kind of misplaced homosexuality or something like that. If I'm understanding him correctly, I might not be. It's a book I always want to use more and yet just can't figure out ways to use more, because I know it has had this huge impact in the history of masculinity, like the historiography of masculinity. I've reached a point in my life where I'm happy to not read Jacques Lacan, and I'll leave it at that. Whether or not I'm using like psychoanalytic theory, I think that idea of like something that should belong to us has been stolen from us is something that really recurs in this kind of material. And even this quote I used at the start from Gargi Bhattacharya's recent book, I think is very much getting at that like we and people like Christoph Kerl and Talia Levin as well, I think their work is really studying how the contemporary far right is really kind of engage in that kind of argument about we being white men, we should have access to white women, and we do not. It has been taken from us. But they say it's, you know, there's a kind of an odd logic at work there, a very, very odd logic about it has been taken from us because of feminism and because of the Black Civil Rights Movement. And that's all the fault of the Jews. So they identify a problem as coming from feminism and coming from Black politics, and then they say it's Jews that have ultimately stolen this from us. And there is a very kind of, there's a certain kind of playing out of political logic there, I think, that you can say this is the fault of women, but then you're admitting that women tricked men and women are actually smarter than men. Or you can say this is the fault of Black people, but then you're admitting that Black people are actually quite smart and they're capable and able to pull off like a big political heist on white people. So they need some kind of a group of people who are utterly evil, but also are able to outsmart white men. And the only people they can find to do that are Jews, which is kind of how I've come to eventually realize like why it is that so much of like things like incels and these kinds of online cultures have recourse to anti-Semitism so easily, because it's a playing out of something that has obviously nothing to do with Jews. It's to do with their own white male, a sense of white male supremacy. So I don't use psycho, I guess that's not like a psychoanalytic argument, but it is what I've ended up with as my way of understanding this stuff.
Thanks, Aidan. A question from Jenny O'Gorman. Do you think sexual fantasy functions differently on an individual basis to the way it functions culturally and socially? I'm thinking a little bit about the psychodynamics of groups and organizations and whether there is space within that area of thought for sexual fantasy taking a role performing a function.
So I definitely struggle with, like, you know, I'm obviously just making a whole lot of assumptions about how people are reading this stuff, like these Nazi cartoons. I assume that this is like a mass sense of impotence that then plays out at an individual level about your own sense of sexual failure. And therefore it you explain the individual problem at a macro level. And a lot of the stuff I was just talking about of like online cultures that kind of explain their status in life through anti-Semitism and through a sense of sexual failure. I'm not sure if that's kind of what you mean by like psychodynamics of groups and organizations. Something I think I want to think about more as I develop this project is there is a danger that I'm ascribing one specific explanation to each image, and there might be like, how much is this stuff actually designed to have multiple meanings and therefore like appeal to people in multiple different ways, or appeal to diverse audiences in different ways?
Thank you, Aidan. Jack Gilbert expresses surprise you have not considered queer or LGBTQ plus dimensions of sexualization, fetishism, and anti-Semitism. There are well-documented examples from Nazi, far-right, and Islamist sources, and from lived intersectional Jewish gay experience.
So I might take him up on what he says next, but he's pleased to speak to that. I would love if you could just email me, and I'd love to know more about that. In some way, like the actual lived experience of Jewish people is not something that this project really has anything to say about. But I would love to know more about the Nazi far right and Islamist sources that you're talking about.
Just to give you a bit of an outline. Sure. For example, if you look at the rhetoric around the Institute for Study of Sexology by Magnus Hirschfeld, by the Nazis, there you have a lot of basically conjoined homophobic, transphobic, anti-Semitic rhetoric. But in addition, this idea of making Jews the ultimate queer is not a rare example. You can find all sorts of elisions of those two in the most contemporary far-right and anti-Islamist materials as well. And I just think it's worth, as it were, looking in those kinds of places, and you'll find some really clear examples, and indeed examples of historic figures and individuals in concentration camps who were treated in a particular way that elided these two together. I mean, if you look at Sachsenhausen particularly, you will find that there are specific stories that have been well documented. Most of the material is in German, but there has been a lot of material around this coming out of several research groups, mostly in Germany, but not exclusively, but also a few in the States as well. And in terms of Islamism, it's not at all uncommon to see rhetoric which elides homosexuality and Jews in order to just make it to really emphasize the level of reprehensible antisocial and kind of queerness of the above. So it's actually not an uncommon rhetorical tool at all. And it has impacted even in London politics with people like Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who was actually the subject of a joint campaign by both LGBT and Jewish organizations in the noughties. So I'm just giving you a few examples there. And in terms of lived experience, actually what happens, and they've also got things like Scott Lively, whose Pink Swastika is an archetypal revisionist document, essentially arguing that contemporary gay rights activists are inheritors of Nazism. And he is actually the person who has been behind a lot of the homophobic church-based campaigns in Africa. So there's a whole load of material there that it's worth looking at, definitely.
Sure, sure. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jack. There are two more questions here. One's very short, so we'll take them together. The first question from Romy. Ron Weber asks, what can be done to stop these false narratives? I'm not sure if that's something which is of interest to you, Aidan. And from Lisa Leff, thanks you for the excellent presentation. It struck Lisa that in the context you were talking about, Jews were never the only other that existed alongside other minorities, also imagined as threatening or repulsive. Did you encounter representations that put multiple others into fantasies together? And if so, are there patterns in how Jews are represented vis-a-vis other others?
So in terms of the first question, I think the best place to look for that, or at least one very good place to look, is in Talia Levin's book, her final chapters about how do you fight the far right. And her argument is you fight it with militancy, with kind of militant anti-fascism, which would be my position too. I'm also not someone who is, that's not where this project is trying to go. So I'm not the best person to ask, I think, about that. In terms of depicting Jews alongside others, I had this postcard that I started with, that's a kind of early 20th century postcard of this kind of claim about, something about Jews and pork sausages. And it's from the YIVO archives in New York, where I was doing research recently. They have a particular collection of vaudeville era material. So there's songbooks, postcards, and then joke books. There's a very interesting kind of problem that I realized from looking through this material, that sometimes you do see a lot of Jews depicted, a lot of images of Jews depicted alongside other racial groups. And sometimes this makes a certain kind of sense, or there's some kind of logic playing out there, and sometimes it just doesn't. So there's a lot of depictions of Jews and Irish people. Usually where there's a very similar thing in how Jews and Irish people are depicted in late 19th, early 20th century America, you can spot them always by their noses. Jews have big hook noses in these cartoons. Irish people always have what's called a pug nose, which, I mean, I'm a living example that they don't, right? This kind of pig-like nose that marks an Irish person. And you could place that into a kind of a history of like the question of whiteness in the US and how these like white ethnic minorities become part of the American mainstream, that these are caricatures that kind of demonize them. And then by overcoming these caricatures, Irish people and Jewish people assimilate into mainstream American life. There are quite a few images that I came across of Jews as cowboys. in this material, and it's always kind of look at how funny it would be if a Jewish person tried to be a cowboy, or if a Jewish man tried to be a cowboy, that they are incapable of like living up to this kind of masculine frontier, like this frontier masculinity. And there is a certain, you know, again, there's a certain kind of logic to that within how the claims that anti-Semitism makes about Jews and about Jewish men. And then there was just a load of stuff that I came across of Jews as Native Americans. And I couldn't really figure out why they were doing this. And I think, I do think in hindsight now, it's just, there's a whole load of stereotypes about Jews. There's a whole load of stereotypes about Native Americans. It's just for the people who are reading this material, it's just funnier if you can have two stereotypes instead of one. There's no real like deeper logic to this. It's just racial humor. There are like joke books that are in this collection that I was looking at, of jokes about Jews that often are claiming Jews and Irish, or jokes that put Jewish people and Irish people together. And the humor is always like, they can't quite speak English properly. And then there are jokes, there was one particular joke book of Irish, Jewish and Dutch jokes. And I think it's just people like making fun of Dutch people, I guess, in early 20th century America. There's no necessary logic to that. You'll also find, I mean, in a lot of Nazi material, there's often a claim that Jews are kind of like Africans, which is a certain playing out of how the Nazis understood race. I think there's always a problem with this kind of material that this might just be so extreme that it's hard to find a logic to it. That's always a kind of a concern I have at the back of my mind to a certain degree.
Thanks, Aidan. I wonder if I can end with a question of my own, which in a way picks up on one of your earlier comments, which is how I think rightly pointed out how a Jewish studies, like lots of other studies, feels it can be rather insular, and you're trying to move it away from that. But one of the interesting things about your approach is that in trying to do so, on the one hand, by drawing on interdisciplinary studies from other fields, you make the move in that way to enable you to actually draw a line over a very long period of time. And in a way, that strategy creates an affinity between what you're doing and some of the most small C conservative understandings of anti-Semitism as the longest hatred, which pays less attention to the context and the meanings in particular moments. And I wonder if that sort of tendency, which comes from taking a long-term view, is only further drawn out by the subject matter, because it's about sex and sexual fantasy, and that which it can lead one to think about something inherent in people's natures, which exists in a timeless way. So I wonder whether just reflecting and thinking out loud about your excellent paper, whether there are gains as well, whether there are losses as well as gains in the strategy that you're employing.
So one thing I say in the fuller version that I didn't want to say here, because I'm not quite sure if I'm confident enough to say it yet, but I'll say it anyway now, I guess. One of the points I end by making is that if we do assume that anti-Semitism is really pleasurable in some way to anti-Semites, can that in some ways explain the odd persistence of anti-Semitism? So there's a problem that I think comes up a lot in American history and in the history of racism in the US about why does racism actually survive, right? There's a very good book by David Rudger called How Race Survived US History. And that does seem to be a kind of a perennial problem in the study of anti-Semitism too. So the essay that I quoted by Heschel, by Susanna Heschel, she ends by saying, you know, she says, we need to be both really alert to the fact that this is different in different times and places, right? And a post-Versailles German anxiety about German impotence is very, very different to a 13th century English anxiety about Jews as moneylenders, or a kind of early capitalist English anxiety that emerges in a figure like Shylock. That these are very different times and places, and yet the vocabulary and the kind of tropes are quite similar. In that sense, that kind of, you know, the kind of longest hatred view of anti-Semitism is kind of correct, or it is pointed to something that is true. Mm-hmm. I think you don't, in theory, you shouldn't lose anything if you do that. If you do that, what Heschel does, or what David Nuremberg tries to do in anti-Judaism, to say this is the same language, but it's emerging from different times and places. I'm not sure if that's actually possible, though, because Nuremberg's book does read like an incredibly coherent narrative over, I mean, he goes over 3,000 years. I see a couple of comments there about historicizing, and one thing that I've been quite surprised by as I've given this paper in a couple of different places is that medievalists have not just massively taken me to task, because I have been quite worried about, am I ascribing kind of modern style meanings to medieval texts? That is definitely something I want to think about more as I work on this more. You know, my reading of like a Judensau image is not necessarily one that I haven't gotten called out on it yet. So I'm hoping I'm doing the right thing, but I'm alert to the fact that I might not be.
Thank you, Aidan. We're out of time, unfortunately, but what remains is for me to thank everyone for coming along today. Especially for the excellent questions and comments, and above all, my thanks, and I'm sure everyone else's thanks, to Aidan for a wide-ranging and hugely stimulating paper, and leaving me, and I'm sure everyone else, with much to think about. And I'd like to suggest that before we go, we with emojis or in whatever way we do, we applaud and thank Aidan for his paper. Thank you very much.